Thanks, Patrick.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I'm Colby. I'm an alcoholic. And welcome to the new people. Thank you to Jeff and Anita for flying up here to see me speak. I appreciate it. I said I'm an alcoholic, and that's the truth. You know, I appreciate what Jack had to say, because the truth is, for me, at some point in my life, I don't know, 15, 16 years old, alcohol became a solution for me, right? It wasn't just that it made me feel better. It wasn't just that I had fun doing it. It became a solution to my problem, right? And I had this problem. I had this problem with life. And I say had, that's sort of a lie. I have this problem with life. And what I mean by that is, I don't see it clearly. You know, that's what it really comes down to. It's about perspective. The little things are big for me, and the big things are little for me. And small fears are massive in my head. And reactions that I have to certain things are way overblown. And feelings that I have about certain things are non-existent in some cases. Or at least I project that. I just don't know how to live life. And what happened for me a little bit sooner than for Jack was that when I was 7 years old, my sister, who was a number of years older than me, decided to get the little kid drunk. She and her girlfriends got me drunk on a Sunday night. My mother traveled a lot, and I had a great time. But what it did for me real quick was it pointed out to me that I could figure out how to have a good time by involving booze. And so I started to get my friends involved, and it was easily accessible because my mother drank a lot, and when she was home, she was either drinking or passed out, but she was gone three to three and a half weeks a month, and my 14-year-old sister took care of me, and so I had access to booze, and I had a lot of fun with that for a lot of time. But eventually, it started to become I won't call it a crutch, but it started to become that solution. You know, it just really was that thing that I needed to be able to face life on a daily basis. Because if you're a drunk like me, you're selfish, you're self-centered, and you're fear-based. And I operate from that position on a daily basis, you know. And I couldn't have told you that then, but I was scared, you know. And I needed booze to help me get through it. And so by the time I was 15, 16 years old, I was drinking on a regular basis as often as I could. Unfortunately for me, my mother had gotten sober, so booze got a little bit harder to get. Fortunately for me, I had a beard when I was 15, so I could get booze pretty soon. But I drank, you know, and I can't say that, you know, I was compelled to drink. I can't say that. I needed booze, and I needed booze to feel right, and I needed booze to fit in with you, and I needed booze to get people to like me, and I needed booze for showing up to school in the morning. You know, that's what it ended up being for me. Was by the time I was a junior or senior in high school, I needed booze in the morning, you know, and I would take off at lunch. And as a result, I, you know, went from being a subpar, below average student to a non-existent student. And I didn't graduate high school because of my need to fit in with you guys. And I tell you all of that because that's sort of where we start, right? That's sort of where we get. But what happened for me was booze took off, and it became the most important thing. And, you know, I wasn't that guy that focused on it because it was always there. But I have an uncle that was telling me about how he started going to Alcoholics Anonymous because he knew he was an alcoholic. And I had never seen this guy drink. And when I asked him his story, he said, well, I only have one beer a week. That's all I ever drank. From when I married my wife until I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had one beer a week. And I was like, how are you an alcoholic? That doesn't make any sense to me. And what he described for me was that he spent every waking moment of that week leading up to that beer, planning it and savoring it and thinking about what it was going to be like. And I throw that out there because if there's anyone here who has sworn off or made that solemn oath or was told by a doctor that they needed to stop for a while, and then they did get that drink, for me, I mean, it really was that. As soon as it touched your tongue, it hadn't even gotten into my bloodstream yet, but as soon as it touched my tongue and as soon as it started to go down my throat, heck, before it even got to my mouth, when I was just looking at it sitting on the counter and the little bead of sweat went down the side of the bottle, right? That's what makes me an alcoholic, is that I'm looking at that bottle and I know what happens when I drink it. And yet I need it more than anything in this world because it is my solution. It is what allows me to fit in with the rest of the world. It is what allows me to go to work. It is what allows me to have a conversation with you. It's what allowed me to be able to have a relationship with my family because I couldn't stand my family. It was what I needed, and it still is, right? The problem for me is that I've been sober a little over 15 years, and even today, I know for a fact, without Alcoholics Anonymous, if the wheels fell off and everything else was shot, taking a drink would solve my problem. I know that for a fact. When I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, I find that there's actually another solution that can replace that. But I didn't find that for a long time. I spent a lot of time out there drinking and being selfish and being self-centered and moving around and burning bridges and hurting people. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was fully convinced that all of the relationships that I had burned were burned because of my drinking. And it wasn't until I had been here for a little while that I realized it wasn't because of my drinking. It was because of who I was when I wasn't drinking. Because all I could think about was myself. All I could care about was what I could get from you. And it was acting that way that cut me off from you, that created this loneliness, that made it necessary for me to take my medicine, that made it necessary for me to drink that vodka. You know, I can remember my first drunk. I don't remember my first drink. And I can remember my last night of drinking. Not my last drink, because I was in a blackout, but I can remember the drink that I took to start that night off. And I can remember that feeling of, as soon as I took it. And at that point, it didn't matter for me. It didn't matter what was coming after that. And that's the problem for a drunk like me, because I know bad things happen when I drink. Right? Handcuffs, stitches, hospitals, drunk tanks, accidents. Hurting people. I know what happens. But none of that means a thing. You know, knowledge of what's going to happen when I pick up a drink is not going to keep me from picking up a drink. And the last couple of years of my drinking was spent like that, knowing that I needed to stop, knowing that there was a problem, knowing that if I kept doing this, if I kept focusing on myself, and if I kept drinking to make myself feel better for treating you the way I've been treating you, that it was going to be bad. And what really happened for me is it got bad. you know, the book talks about this loneliness. And I wouldn't have described it then. Because I had friends. You know, there were people around me. But the truth is that even when I was drinking, when I got home at night, I didn't want to be there. I needed to go back out because I knew that sitting with myself without being able to drink and ignore what I was really like, I would start to realize who and what I really was. You know, and I would lay in bed and I would stare at the ceiling and I wasn't sleeping very well. I was sick because I was drinking so much. and I would smoke cigarettes and I would lay in my bed and I would smoke cigarettes and I would think about how awful my life was and how much I just wish it would go away. And after I thought about that for a while, I would think to myself, I got to stop drinking. And at some point I would fall asleep or pass out, and the next day would come, and I would wake up, and I would be standing in the kitchen, and I would grab a bottle of vodka out of the freezer, and I would take a pop, having just thought to myself, I've got to stop drinking. I couldn't do it, you know. And what really happened for me wasn't that alcohol stopped working for me, because like I said, I know today alcohol would still work for me. I know it would solve my problem for a short period of time, a few minutes maybe, but it would definitely take the pain away. What happened for me is the consequences of my drinking started to outweigh the benefit that I got from that booze, to the point where I was scared, more scared than I was of not being able to stop drinking. And some bad things happened. You know, I got an accident while I was drinking, and somebody may or may not have gotten hurt. Police officer told me that I had hurt some people really bad. Actually, a cop, as he was taking me to the drunk tank, told me that I had killed a woman and two kids when someone was slightly injured in the accident. You know, and he probably did it to teach me a lesson. And after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous a few days later, somebody told me that there might come a time when I might be grateful to that guy for having done that. I can't say that I'm there yet, you know. And that's the truth, you know, because for about 24 hours in the drunk tank, I was convinced I was never going home. But I do know that what that guy did for me was kick me off the cliff, right? I was standing at that jumping off place, and that guy kicked me off and made me willing enough to ask for help. And what happened after that is I was graced with enough willingness to follow some direction. And a guy named Patrick O came and picked me up and introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life. 100%. I was a cynical, angry, unloving, fear-based, and I say fear-based, I was scared to death of everything. Piece of garbage human being is how I would describe it, you know. There are probably people who knew me then who wouldn't describe it that way, but that's how I felt, you know. That's exactly how I felt, just that gut-sick disgust with who I was. And I knew nobody wanted to be around me, and I knew nobody wanted to see me, least of all my family. And I was just terrified. You know, I was terrified because I couldn't stop drinking, and I knew that it was the only thing that made it better. So I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had been around Alcoholics Anonymous for years. My mother got sober when I was 13. My stepfather was sober the entire time I knew him. My sister got sober. My brother-in-law was sober. Half my friends were in AA. I mean, it was like, I knew what AA was. I just, it couldn't help me. And so I get to AA, and these guys start taking me around, and I just didn't get it. You know, I didn't really get why I was here. I certainly didn't get the steps. I had zero experience with God, although I, like Jack, had, you know, for the last 5 or 6 years, been seeking something because I had read all these books, you know, The Artist's Way. I was reading, doing this, you know, Buddhist stuff. I don't even remember what it was because I was drunk half the time. But I knew I was seeking something. And I get to AA and they start talking about God, and they start talking about how these steps are going to introduce you to God, and they start talking about these spiritual experiences, and they start talking about all this stuff. And I'm like, I don't get it. I just can't drink, you know. I was that slow. You know, I remember sitting in the car with Patrick and we were driving down the freeway. And he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I just don't want to get any more DUIs. I don't want that to happen again." And he goes, "Well, good news. I got two choices for you. You can stop drinking or you can stop driving." You know, and if you're anything like me, you had to stop and think about that for a little while. But so I get to AA and I start following these guys around. And I say following these guys around, I didn't follow anyone around. These guys grabbed me and dragged me around Alcoholics Anonymous. And they got me involved really early. They got me involved in intergroup. You know, it's been wonderful tonight. I've seen so many people that I've done service with over the years. But, you know, I got started in intergroup when I had 6 months of sobriety. I think my sponsor lied to them about my time, because I'm pretty sure you needed a year to do intergroup. But I got involved in intergroup at 6 months, and I did it for 8 or 9 years, and I got to know a lot of people. But what happened is these guys just started dragging me around, you know, and they started showing me what they do, and they started showing me how they live. And what I saw was a bunch of guys, and I say guys, but I mean all of you, ladies too. I saw a bunch of people who were feeling the same things that I was feeling. But they didn't show it. And they didn't seem to act on it. And they didn't seem to hate themselves the way I felt like I hated myself. And they didn't seem to be afraid, right? I mean, I got to be honest, that was probably the biggest thing for me when I got here, is I saw these people who I heard them share and I heard them talk, and they talked like I felt. And they talked about things that were going on in my head and my heart. But they didn't seem afraid. And for me, that was just enough to give me hope that this thing might work. And so I just kept letting them drag me around, you know. I went to conferences and I got involved in service, and I went to a lot of AA meetings, and I started working the steps. You know, and I worked the steps, and for a while I told people I had a spiritual experience and that I had found a God. And the truth is, I hadn't. God had certainly found me, because he was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. But I didn't believe it, and I didn't feel it, and I didn't really get it, and I was doing that sort of fake it till you make it thing. And frankly, I was being dishonest. I was telling you that I had a God, but I really didn't believe it. And what happened for me is I just got involved in AA, and I started to do it, and I started to exert the same will and the same fear-based actions that I had before I got to AA in AA. And I found myself at, I don't know, 7 or 8 years of sobriety, sitting in these rooms, being as alone as I was when I walked into AA. And not through any fault of your own, through my own selfish thinking, right? I was sitting there and I was judging you, and I had decided that there was a way that this thing needed to be done, even though it wasn't really working for me, but there was a right way that this thing should be done. And if you didn't do it just this way, you were doing it wrong, and I was judging you. And what was really going on is I was being a mean guy in AA, and people were judging me. Right? Judging you. Judging me. Judging you. And I was alone, and I was scared, and something needed to change. And I got to be honest, I don't know what of the changes that I made had the effect to introduce me to, or get me to, a place where I felt the presence of God. I mean, there had been moments where I had felt the presence of God. I heard my first fifth step, and I remember thinking, man, this has got to be God. There's no way that I could be doing this. I had those moments, but I couldn't live. I couldn't live this spiritual experience. I couldn't feel like God was a part of my life, right? He was just sort of over there, and every once in a while he stepped in. And what happened was I had to switch everything up. I switched up my meetings. I switched up my sponsor. I switched up my practice. I started to, instead of, you know, say those prayers or read the prayers out of the book, I started to have a conversation with God, even though I wasn't really sure he was there. I started to have this conversation with God, you know, and instead of, you know, doing this quiet meditation where I would set the timer and force myself to meditate, I would just sit there and I would have a thought about what my day is going to be like, and what's coming to me, you know, and what do I need God's help with, and how can I align my will with what God would have me be. And these things, right, that are all in the book, you know, but I hadn't read them before, but they're all there. And I just started to do things different. And what happened was, you know, no white light, no out-of-body experience, nothing like that. I started to develop a relationship with a higher power. And I started to feel comfortable again, you know. I started to feel like I did in the first year or two of sobriety. I started to feel like there was hope. I started to feel like I started to feel like everything was okay, you know. Not that everything was going to be okay. That everything was okay. And I don't know how it happened. I really don't. I wish I could, you know, put my finger on it other than a practice, you know, attempting to take the principles that are found in the first 164 pages of the book and apply them to my life as a way of life one day at a time. I started to feel okay. I started to know that it was okay. I started to believe that this was the solution for me. I started to develop a relationship with that higher power, and I started to really feel like I can do this, you know, that I can stay sober and I can live my life no matter what's coming my way without being too scared. And, you know, I did a lot of work around that. And, you know, we do the fourth step in the book. And we talk about fears, and I remember the first time I made a fear list. The first time I did the fear list, I wrote down I wasn't afraid of anything. But that's because I thought I was a tough guy. You know, but I remember at one point I did this fears list that was, I don't know, 10, 15 pages long, you know, and I started to realize that I really was afraid of everything. And over a period of time, I started to realize that almost all of those fears, first of all, they were self-centered fears. But second of all, they all could be boiled down into a couple of different categories. And I've reached this place where today it's much easier for me to sort of analyze my motives and analyze my position in whatever conversation I'm having based on these three fears that I can boil every single one of the fears that I have down into. And that's fear of not getting what I want, fear of losing what I have, and fear of what you think of me. Right? Every single fear that I have boils down to one of those three things. And if I can put myself in a place where I recognize that I'm operating on fear, and that's really easy for me, because when I'm operating on fear, I can just look at your face and tell that you're either afraid of me or really angry at me. And I know I'm operating on from a place of fear because I've either said or done something to offend you. I can very quickly throughout the day say a little prayer. You know, God, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm pretty sure you do. And if you show me, I'll try. And that's become my prayer. That's become my conversation with God. Every morning when I wake up and I'm sitting in my chair and I'm doing my little morning practice, which really, I call it a practice. It's not that deep. I literally sit in my chair and I say just that. And then I try to sit quietly and think about the day that I have ahead of me. And then eventually, my son or my daughter will climb out of bed and they'll come in and they'll crawl in my lap. And I'll scratch their back. And then I'll know it's time to start making breakfast for the kids. But that's my morning practice. But what I found is that simple little prayer, God, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm pretty sure you do. And if you show me, I'll try. I can say that throughout the day. And all of a sudden, that perspective that I was talking about at the very beginning, that I know is off, is snapped right back in, and I know exactly what I need to do. You know, and it's not that I know the right answer. You know, I was having this conversation with this guy last week at this retreat, and he was asking me what he needed to do. He's like, here's what's going to happen, and it's a really bad thing if I do this, and it's a really bad thing if I do this, but it might be a better thing if it's this way, and it might be... And I just remember thinking to myself, does it really matter? Right? Just do what you think God would have you do. And it doesn't matter what the outcome is. And that was one of those aha moments that I had in AA, that the truth is, my fear causes me to be overly concerned with the outcome of my decisions. More importantly, it causes me to be overly concerned with the outcome of everything, which then causes me to try to control it. You know, it talks about in the third step, the director, or actually the actor who wants to be the director. That was me, right? I would get so worried about what should happen. What should be the result of this? I'm going to go do this, and this should happen. That I would focus on that and forget about what I needed to do to make that happen. And then when that didn't happen, I would be so angry at everyone around me because things didn't go the way that I wanted them to go, that I would just throw my hands up and take off. And that was the cause of my loneliness, right? I didn't get along with anybody. I didn't get along with my family. I didn't get along with my friends. And what it really boiled down to was fear. So when I started to realize that I could not just do this prayer in the morning and do this prayer at night, you know, do the prayer in the morning and ask for guidance and then do the prayer at night and ask for forgiveness, that I could actually bring God with me throughout the day, things started to be okay, you know. Again, not that they were going to be okay, not that I was worried about the outcome, not that I'm talking like this is a regular occurrence. The truth is, it's few and far between, but I try to do it all the time. things are okay, you know. And I didn't get, that idea is not something that I came up with, right? When I got here, a guy named Dave C., his wife was fighting cancer. And that guy struggled and fought. And he kept showing up and he kept doing these things. And I just remember hearing him share about how it just didn't matter anymore if everything was going to be okay. But that he knew everything was okay as long as he just held his wife's hand. And that over the years has always sort of run through my head that if I can get to this place where it just doesn't matter, you know, if I get the job, or it doesn't matter if I get the raise, or it doesn't matter if I get the car, or it doesn't matter if it's just okay right now, you know, if it's just okay right now, then I'm probably in the place where I have a connection with God, because I know that that means I'm just going to put my foot where God would have me put it and follow that path to the best of my ability. And what do I get for doing that over a period of time? Not much. I get a hard time from my sponsor. I get a hard time from Mark before the meeting. You know, but what I really get is a little bit of peace of mind. And there's sort of been this weird side effect of having come to AA for a long period of time and started to develop a relationship with this higher power. And I say started to because it's new. You know, I was 8-9 years sober before I started to really feel it. So I'm hoping that if I just keep doing this, that I'll be able to do it more and more, right? Because right now what happens is I try to do this thing, and then I'll sit down with my sponsor, and he'll say, you know, ask me that really tough question, how you doing? And I'll say I'm fine, and he'll say something like, well, maybe you should tell your face that. To be fair, he's never actually said that to me. But that's what it feels like when I say, oh, I'm fine. And he goes, oh, really? Because I do get all nutted up. You know, I do get caught up in my fear and that lack of perspective. And that's important, right? Because if I weren't talking to my sponsor, I wouldn't recognize it. I need to have that transparency with my sponsor so that I can get back to that place. But back to the side effect of having done this for a period of time, of having been transparent with a sponsor, of having tried to develop this relationship with a higher power, of having worked the steps a number of times out of the book, of having taken other guys through the book, the side effect for me is love. I've come to a place where I can look around this room, and some of you know, and some of you I know, and some of you I don't. But know that I love you guys. Not just you guys, but the people out there. Like, I can come from a place of love today rather than fear because I've developed this relationship with a higher power. And what happens for me when I come from a place of love is every once in a while it comes back. You know? And I don't feel so lonely. And I don't feel so afraid. And I start to recognize that even though booze is a solution for me, I don't feel like I need that to be my solution today because I have something that's better. And the side effect of it is love. So thanks for asking me to do this, Mark. I appreciate it, guys.
Good job. Thank you very much. Okay.